From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And another important day on Capitol Hill. The House Judiciary Committee is hearing today from legal experts who are making the case for and against the impeachment of President Trump. Harvard Law School professor Noah Feldman said the president's actions are enough to remove him from office.
High crimes and misdemeanors are abuses of power and of public trust connected to the office of the presidency. On the basis of the testimony and the evidence before the House, President Trump has committed impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors by corruptly abusing the office of the presidency.
At issue is whether Trump abused his office by asking the leader of Ukraine to investigate Trump's political rival in exchange for military aid and a White House meeting. NPR's congressional reporter Claudia Grisales is on Capitol Hill, and she joins us now. Claudia, welcome.
Hi there.
So today's hearing, very different from what we heard from the Intelligence Committee. The focus today is on legal questions, not necessarily establishing new facts. What are we hearing from the witnesses?
Yes, this is a very different look. When we saw the Intel hearings, we were seeing witnesses who were bringing facts forth towards the impeachment investigation. Now we are looking at the Judiciary Committee holding their first hearing in this formal inquiry, and they are bringing forth these law professors. Three of them are professors called by the Democrats, one by the Republicans. And as far as the professors for the Democrats who were called are saying, they're telling lawmakers the evidence that was discovered through this phase with the Intelligence Committee is what is basically what the framers of the Constitution were warning against. This is why they included the impeachment option in the Constitution, because of fear that the president would abuse the power of the office. And they're saying the evidence is very clear that the president has abused the power of his office by using this military aid as a way to extract a political favor and seek, if you will, re-election.
And on the other hand, you've got George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, the one witness called by the Republicans, as you said, says he's not a supporter of President Trump, but the House impeachment inquiry is wrong.
I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger.
Tell us more about Professor Turley's argument.
Yes. So Professor Turley is telling lawmakers that he's worried about this abundance of anger, that that is what is fueling this impeachment probe, and it's not sufficient ground to pursue an impeachment. However, the Democratic counsel, Norm Eisen, pointed out that this professor had written an opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal and said that there was much worthy of investigations when it came to this Ukraine affair, and impeachment doesn't necessarily require a crime.
Okay, and perhaps not surprisingly, the hearings have been heated already. Republicans keep trying to bring up procedural issues. They're interrupting the chairman, Jerry Nadler. Here's Republican Andy Biggs of Arizona.
Can you please also iterate the schedule going forward? In other words, are you planning to hold additional hearings? And if so, when do you anticipate?
The gentleman will suspend.
Releasing or
that is not a proper parliamentary inquiry.
Okay, so there was a lot of that today so far, Claudia. Is that a strategy on the Republicans' part?
Yes, this is clearly a strategy for Republicans. I spoke to another member of the panel earlier this week, Jim Jordan, and he said that Republicans didn't plan on stopping the hearing today outright, but they were going to raise all kinds of issues and concerns. He said, quote, that's what we do in these things when the process is ridiculous. So, yes, this is part of an overall strategy for Republicans, and we could see more to come.
So these are the legal experts, as we said, but do you expect to hear from anyone else, any more fact-based witnesses in the Judiciary Committee?
Well, Judiciary is keeping their plans for future hearings very, very tight to a close circle of members. They're not sharing outside of that group quite yet of their plans coming up. But we understand there could be more hearings coming next week. We're waiting for the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, to present his case, their panel's findings to Judiciary. That could come next week. I spoke to another Democrat this morning after a meeting among among the caucus members, and they said that it's possible that we could see articles of impeachment, not next week, but the following week, the week of the 16th.
And of course, that is the point of today's hearings, the committee deciding whether or not to take the information from the Intelligence Committee and draft articles of impeachment. So we're going to keep a close eye on that all day long. NPR's congressional reporter, Claudia Grisales. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the stock market partially rebounded this morning after a steep drop earlier in the week. Investors were concerned after the president said that he may wait until after the 2020 election to make a trade deal with China. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy.
So does anyone have any idea what is going to happen with the trade war? Because it seems like the market goes up or down based on some comment that somebody in the administration makes about the trade talks. But if anything, in the long term, the trade war has only gotten more intense over time.
Well, in answer to your question, Jeremy, no, nobody knows what's going to happen. Maybe Donald Trump and President Xi of China have an idea, but certainly some of the moves this week caught people completely by surprise, like the president's announcement of renewed tariffs on South American metal on Monday. Mm-hmm. That was completely out of the blue. I remember a deposition where the president in his private life once said that he felt his own net worth it rose and fell on the basis of his moods. And now we know that the stock market also rises and falls on the basis of the president's moods. If he hints that a trade deal with China might be a year away, as he did yesterday, we see a tumble in the market. Then when something like happens like today with Bloomberg saying maybe a deal with China, at least a mini deal with China, is closer at hand, we see some rebound.
And we'll keep watching the ups and downs as a result of all of that. Let's talk about some economic indicators that we actually do know about right now. GDP growth, Scott, has held steady about 2% for many months now. The president promised after his election it would be higher than that. But what does that 2% number tell you?
It tells me that the economy is growing at about the same pace as it was before President Trump came into office. We got a revision on the third quarter GDP. It was just north of 2%. Forecast for the fourth quarter are a little south of 2%. Probably for the year, we'll average somewhere above 2, but well shy of the 3% target that the White House had offered. And really, that was the argument for the big GOP tax cut at the end of 2017. Mm-hmm. Cut those taxes, especially on companies, and we'll see a huge influx of investment that'll boost productivity, and we'll get sustained 3% economic growth for years and years to come. We did get an acceleration of growth to 3%, but it proved to be short-lived, what some have called a sugar rush, and now it looks like we're back to growing at about the pace we were before President Trump came into office.
But with a lot more debt as a result of those tax cuts.
Yes.
What about jobs, Scott? We're going to get the monthly jobs report this Friday. There was a private employment report that came out today. Unemployment rate has been steady, about 3.6% at last check. The jobs picture seems like it's still quite strong.
It is certainly solid, although job growth has slowed a little bit from where it was, say, this time last year. But we should see a solid jobs number when the report comes out on Friday morning. Remember that October's number was a little depressed because of the General Motors strike. That strike's now been resolved, so that's tens of thousands of workers back on mm-hmm. the job. We expect the unemployment rate to remain very low, around 3.6%. Wage growth has been solid, but not spectacular. We've been seeing average hourly wages rising in the neighborhood of 3%, a little bit slower than they were earlier this year, but not bad. That means we've got a lot of Americans working. Their paychecks are going up faster than the rate of inflation. That should be a boost for consumer spending.
Well, and we've seen that, right, in the last week or so with Cyber Monday and Black Friday. Consumers have been spending a lot.
Yes, the holiday shopping season, which is a short one this year, was off to a pretty good start, and that's encouraging because really consumers are the only big leg holding up the U.S. economy right now. Business spending has been kind of in a slump, but consumers are expected to spend pretty healthily this holiday season. Of course, we expected something like that last year, too, only to have consumer sentiment take a take a beating because of trade tensions mm-hmm. and a slump in the stock market. So keep your seatbelt fastened.
What about the housing market, finally? Mortgage rates still near historic lows. 3.88% was the average for a 30-year fixed mortgage last week. What's the state of the housing market right now?
The housing market has rebounded a little bit. Housing had been sort of a slump on the overall economy for about a year and a half. But in the third quarter, for the first time in a long time, we saw housing make a positive contribution to economic growth. That's expected to continue. We have still seen younger people maybe being a little slow to move out into the housing market, even though those interest rates are very low. Home prices in a lot of markets are pretty high. And of course, we've got some young people who are saddled with debt, and especially those who came into the job market during the depths of the recession or just afterwards maybe aren't earning that much. So they've been a little bit slower to buy housing. But we are beginning to see probably a slow recovery in the housing market. And that's been a plus for the economy after being a negative for a long period of time.
That is NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
Always good to talk to you, Jeremy.
Let's take a break from the impeachment hearings for a special Encore 1980s edition of the DJ Sessions. Now, you may remember the last time we did this, we had John and Heidi Small on. They are DJs and co-owners of Sunny Radio. That's an all-80s station in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They are back with us once again. Welcome back to both of you. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks again for inviting us.
Well, and you have to tell us about what happened last time, because apparently your segment got a little more distribution than we thought it would.
Well, and it's funny, we were expecting 15 minutes of fame, and we got more like 25 minutes of fame, because during the last interview, there was a nationwide emergency alert test, and the official ruling is, quote, something went wrong, and our interview got sent out to a whole bunch of additional stations, and up and down the East Coast, they heard us instead of the, you know, this is only a test. They heard us playing an 80s song with you guys, so it was kind of fun. Thank you.
Well, good. You know, sometimes you, instead of hearing that chirp, you just want to hear Take On Me or whatever.
Exactly, and that's the song it was.
That was the one. Okay, good. Well, let's get to some of the music that you brought us today, and this is one that both of you chose together. This is, of course, very famous Don't Stop Believin' by Journey.
A singer in a smoky room, a smell of wine and cheap perfume. For a smile they can share the night. It goes on and on.
And this song has been used everywhere. It is in TV shows, movies. It's the rallying cry for the Chicago White Sox, the LA Dodgers, the Detroit Red Wings, among others. Why is it such an anthem?
I think one of the things, this is the underdog song. This is, you know, anybody that's ever been an underdog, don't stop believing, because you know what? Your time is coming. And I just think that's one of the things that I love about it. And even people who say they don't like it, Heidi was just singing along with it while you were playing.
Well, you can't help it.
Well, Heidi, tell me something I don't know about it, because we've heard it so many times, but this is from the 1981 album Escape.
Well, I think that the really cool thing about this song is it really does kind of sum up that whole decade. The whole decade was really about overcoming such massive debt and high interest rates and all of that stuff. And then that's why it still lives on today, because people can really still appreciate what that song is about.
Okay, the next one you brought us, and this is a Heidi pick. This is Elton John's I'm Still Standing.
You can never know what it's like. Your blood like winter freezes just like ice. And there's a cold and lonely light that shines from you. You wind up like the wreck you hide behind that mask you use. And did you think this fool could never win? Well, look at me, I'm coming back again. I got a taste of
love in a simple way. And if you need to know while I'm still standing, you just fade away. Don't you know I'm still standing better than I ever did? Looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid.
Heidi, this song came out in 1983. It was on the platinum album Too Low for Zero. Why did this song catch on so much?
I personally love this song because it just says, no matter how many times you knock me down, I am going to get back up and I'm going to come back stronger and better than I was before. It reminds all of us that we're stronger than we think, and no matter what life throws at you, you can get back up and you can persevere.
I'm sensing a theme here. I'm still standing. Absolutely. And don't stop believing.
Yes, a little bit.
Well, and Elton John apparently said this song was his reaction to still being relevant and successful in the early 1980s. It is a little bit different than some of his earlier music.
It is. We actually saw him in concert. He was in Sioux Falls about a year and a half ago, and when this song came on, like, the whole place just stood up and was cheering and dancing, because a lot of his other songs are a little slower. So this was kind of I think, for me, a nice change of pace at that concert, and I also think in his career as well.
Okay, up next, we've got a John pick. This is Winners Take All by Quiet Riot.
Price is high when you keep the score. Take your souls and your goals to the top. Together we stand. We won't take no fall. 'Cause we're winners, and winners take all.
Now, John, this is called glam metal.
Yeah. Quiet Riot is the name of the band, and I had a chance to meet the drummer. He's the only original member of the band. His name is Frankie Benelli. Super nice guy. And I asked him, where did the name Quiet Riot come from? Because
I love this story.
It's such a weird name, but it was they had a British friend that, you know, instead of saying, you know, right on or that's right, they say quite right. And when he was saying, they were talking about different names, he said Quiet Riot, but he said it with a British accent, and they thought he said Quiet Riot. And I just, for that, because I wanted to be able to tell that story, there you go. I thought that was just a cool thing.
What do you think of this one, Heidi?
I love this song. How can you not get pumped up listening to this? We have a high school football coach that calls in all the time and requests that song, and he said that when he was in high school, they played this before their games to get everybody all riled up, and he still plays it for his team today. So it's just one of those songs that just gets you ready to go and succeed. I love it.
All right, the next one you brought us is We're Not Gonna Take It. It's by Twisted Sister. And this song is really a classic, John.
Absolutely. And Dee Snider from Twisted Sister, really nice guy. When he was in Sioux Falls, he actually did a class for a bunch of students, like young kids that were in music. And he was calling it, he was teaching them how to be a front man. He said there is a difference between being a singer and being a front man. And he absolutely is a front man. He gets out and he puts on one heck of a show. And he told a story about his first big break when he finally had a chance to go play at Whiskey A Go-Go. And they tried forever to get booked in there. And then when they got in there, he had laryngitis and couldn't sing. And he said, I did everything I could to use the little bit of voice I had left. But he said, you put on a show. As a front man, it's all about the show.
Okay, now I said that there was a theme forming here, but now we really have one. Don't Stop Believing, I'm Still Standing. Winners take all, and we're not going to take it. Heidi, I don't know how you top that at this point.
I just think that whole feeling of all of the songs that we chose today kind of just describes the general overall feeling of the 80s. It was a decade where we kicked butt and took names, and it was such an iconic and awesome time to be alive. And this particular song I absolutely love. This is a great song that you can play anytime somebody screws you over, you get a parking ticket. I mean, whatever. You blast this song and you're going to feel better.
We're not going to take it.
All right. Well, now I have a pick of my own because I like 80s music a lot, too. This is one that for some reason I've been listening to recently. This is Waiting for a Star to Fall. It's by Boy Meets Girl. Here it is. It's interesting, listening to the songs that you brought, which were from 1981, 1983, and 1984, this one sounds very different. This is 1988.
And it's amazing how, as we progress through the decade, music changes. And it's interesting, I read a book called The Pendulum by Roy Williams, and in that book they say the decade doesn't really start until the third year. So it's amazing. There are a lot of songs from 90, 91, 92 that sound like...
They still sound very 80s.
And right? We get requests for them all the time. People asking for these. They go, oh, no, it's from the 80s. We go, no, sorry, it's from 91. As you progress through a decade, that music changes. And I think that's one of the things
like the early 80s, most of it still sounded very 70s sounding for the most part.
Well, while they were trying to win all through the 80s, at this point, they were waiting for that star to fall, I guess.
That's right.
John and Heidi Small, DJs and co-owners of Sunny Radio. That's an all-80s station in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It is always great having you guys on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
And by the way, if there's an emergency going on, we're sorry that you're hearing this instead of the emergency alert system.
I'm not.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations. Thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson. If you feel like your flights are getting canceled more than they used to, you're right. In addition to the winter weather that frequently snarls travel plans, there's an incentive for airlines to cancel more flights. It's called the tarmac delay rule. Let's bring in Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So this is something that was adopted back in 2010. Remind us what it is.
Yeah, so when you have a flight that's stuck away from the gate on the tarmac, that's where the word comes from, for more than 3 hours, and the airline doesn't give passengers a chance to get off, doesn't go back to the gate, for example, the airline can be fined, and we're not talking about a small amount of money. It is $27,500 per passenger on the flight. So the quick math, Jeremy, tells you that's millions of dollars for a flight packed with passengers.
So they would rather just cancel the flight than risk having to pay that money.
Yeah, that's basically the incentive now. Clearly, that's a huge fine. Airlines don't earn nearly that much money. You can easily wipe out a whole day's worth of profits from just one flight stuck away from the gate.
And before 2010, when this law went into effect, this was happening a lot. People would be stuck on the tarmac for hours and hours. I remember there was a plane, a JetBlue plane, I think, that was on there for 6 hours or more.
Exactly. Lots of JetBlue planes. In fact, that was the first widely publicized incident back in 2007. It was Valentine's Day weekend. I actually remember it well. I was stuck there at New York JFK. I happened to come in on Delta. But yeah, JetBlue had basically botched the planning for a snowstorm, and you had all these flights, as you mentioned, one 6 hours, but others various amounts of time, very long amounts of time, without food, water, overflowing toilets, and all kinds of awful conditions. And so that, combined with other subsequent incidents, convinced people that, you know, this is enough. And that's where the government got involved and said, we're going to use a little more stick along with carrots to convince airlines to do anything possible to prevent that.
So how much have cancellations gone up as a result of the tarmac rule?
Well, in the first few years after it, they went up significantly. We're not talking about, you know, double or anything like that, but a meaningful percentage. Since then, airlines have kind of gotten their hands around it, but they are much more conservative about canceling flights well in advance of a storm. And what that means, Jeremy, is that because, look, even with modern meteorology, you don't know exactly what a storm is going to do. If you're trying to cancel flights a day or two out, instead of just sort of flying as long as it's safe to fly and then stop flying, you're going to end up as an airline canceling some flights that, in retrospect, you probably didn't have to cancel. Now, the flip side of it is that after the storm, it's a little easier to get things going again. Nowadays, airlines kind of leave everything in position so that they can restart again after the storm. So fewer cancellations then, but more cancellations going into it. Probably more people inconvenienced in the aggregate, but more comfortably than they used to be because they, you know, they get the notification while they're still at home instead of, you know, sleeping on the floor of an airport.
So just briefly, is there any push to change the tarmac delay rule?
Yeah, there is, because airlines, first of all, have made the case that, you know, sometimes this is just unavoidable, and the DOT has been making exceptions on a case-by-case basis, not finding airlines. They're trying to be more systematic about it and truly get the benefit of it without some of the unintended consequences that we just talked about.
That is Seth Kaplan, Here and Now transportation analyst. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, the House Judiciary Committee picked up the impeachment inquiry into President Trump with testimony from four constitutional scholars. The task before the committee, whether to move forward with articles of impeachment. And we're going to take a moment now to listen to a few highlights from today's testimony, starting with the committee chair, Democrat Jerry Nadler of New York. Here's part of his opening statement.
I do not wish this moment on the country. It is not a pleasant task that we undertake today. But we have each taken an oath to protect the Constitution, and the facts before us are clear. President Trump did not merely seek to benefit from foreign interference in our elections. He directly and explicitly invited foreign interference in our elections. He used the powers of his office to try to make it happen. He sent his agents to make clear that this is what he wanted and demanded. He was willing to compromise our security and his office for personal political gain. It does not matter that President Trump got caught and ultimately released the funds that Ukraine so desperately needed. It matters that he enlisted a foreign government to intervene in our elections in the first place. It does not matter that President Trump felt that these investigations were unfair to him. It matters that he used his office not merely to defend himself, but to obstruct investigators at every turn. We are all aware that the next election is looming, but we cannot wait for the election to address the present crisis. The integrity of that election is one of the very things at stake. The President has shown us his pattern of conduct. If we do not act to hold him in check now, President Trump will almost certainly try again to solicit interference in the election for his personal political gain.
The first witness, Harvard's Noah Feldman, said the president's behavior was impeachable.
President Trump's conduct, as described in the testimony and evidence, clearly constitutes impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors under the Constitution. In particular, the memorandum and other testimony relating to the July 25th, 2019 phone call between the two presidents, President Trump and President Zelensky, more than sufficiently indicates that President Trump abused his office by soliciting the president of Ukraine to investigate his political rivals in order to gain personal political advantage, including in relation to the 2020 election. Again, The words abuse of office are not mystical or magical. They are very clear. The abuse of office occurs when the president uses a feature of his power, the awesome power of his office, not to serve the interests of the American public, but to serve his personal, individual, partisan electoral interests. That is what the evidence before the House indicates. Finally, let me be clear that on its own, soliciting the leader of a foreign government in order to announce investigations of political rivals and perform those investigations would constitute a high crime and misdemeanor. But the House also has evidence before it that the president committed two further acts that also qualify as high crimes and misdemeanors. In particular, the House heard evidence that the president placed a hold on critical U.S. aid to Ukraine and conditioned its release on announcement of the investigations of the Bidens and of the discredited CrowdStrike conspiracy theory. Furthermore, the House also heard evidence that the president conditioned a White House visit desperately sought by the Ukrainian president on announcement of the investigations. Both of these acts constitute impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors under the Constitution. They each encapsulate the framers' worry that the president of the United States would take any means whatever to ensure his reelection. And that is the reason that the framers provided for impeachment in a case like this one.
Republicans have repeatedly interrupted the hearings with parliamentary inquiries in an attempt to slow down a process they're calling unfair and partisan. Here's a taste of that.
Mr. Chairman, I seek
recognition. The gentleman's time has expired.
Mr. Chairman, I seek recognition.
The gentleman was gentleman is recognized.
I offer a motion to postpone to a date certain.
I move to table the motion.
Motion to table is heard and is not debatable. All in favor of the motion to table. All in favor of the motion.
May we have the motion read, please?
The motion was stated as to adjourn to its date.
May we have the motion read, please?
The motion will be read as to what date?
Motion to be read to a date certain, Wednesday, December 11, 2019, so we can actually get a response to the six letters.
The gentleman has stated his motion. The motion to table is made?
Correct.
Motion to table is made and not debatable. All in favor? The motion to table will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion to table is agreed to.
Roll call.
Roll call is requested. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Nadler?
Aye.
Mr. Nadler votes aye. Ms. Lofgren?
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye. Ms. Jackson?
Chairman Nadler there using a roll call to get the hearing back on track. Now, three of the witnesses today testified that President Trump's behavior fits the historical definition of high crimes and misdemeanors. But the fourth and the only one called by Republicans disagreed. Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School said it was highly inappropriate for President Trump to ask Ukraine to investigate his political rival, but he said it would be wrong to impeach.
It's not wrong because President Trump is right. His call was anything but perfect. It's not wrong because the House has no legitimate reason to investigate the Ukrainian controversy. It's not wrong because we're in an election year. There is no good time for an impeachment. No, it's wrong because this is not how you impeach an American president. This case is not a case of the unknowable. It's a case of the peripheral. We have a record of conflicts, defenses that have not been fully considered, unsubpoenaed witness with material evidence. To impeach a president on this record would expose every future president to the same type of inchoate impeachment. Principle often takes us to a place we would prefer not to be. That was the place seven Republicans found themselves in the Johnson trial, when they saved a president from acquittal that they despised. For generations, they've been celebrated as profiles of courage. Senator Edmund Ross said it was like looking down into his open grave. And then he jumped because he didn't have any alternative. It's easy to celebrate those people from the distance of time and circumstance. In an age of rage, it's appealing to listen to those saying, forget the definitions of crimes, just do it. Like this is some impulse buy Nike sneaker. You can certainly do that. You can declare the definitions of crimes alleged are immaterial and just an exercise of politics. not the law. However, those legal definitions and standards, which I've addressed in my testimony, are the very thing that divide rage from reason.
The Democrats' lawyer, Norm Eisen, asked Pamela Carlin of Stanford to explain what concerns the framers of the Constitution had about foreign powers corrupting American elections.
It isn't just our national interest in protecting our own elections. It's not just our national interest in making sure that the Ukraine remains strong and on the front lines so they fight the Russians there and we don't have to fight them here. But it's also our national interest in promoting democracy worldwide. And if we look hypocritical about this, if we look like we're asking other countries to interfere in our election, if we look like we're asking other countries to engage in criminal investigations of our president's political opponents, then we're not doing our job of promoting our national interest in being that shining city on a hill.
Professor Feldman, anything to add?
Ultimately, the reason that the Constitution provided for impeachment was to anticipate a situation like the one that is before you today. The framers were not prophets, but they were very smart people with a very sophisticated understanding of human incentives. And they understood that a president would be motivated naturally to try to use the tremendous power of office to gain personal advantage, to keep himself in office, to corrupt the electoral process, and potentially to subvert the national interest. The facts strongly suggest that this is what President Trump has done, and under those circumstances, the framers would expect the House of Representatives to take action in the form of impeachment.
A few highlights from today's impeachment hearing before the House Judiciary Committee.
I went on vacation for a few days last week and deleted all social media from my phone. Sad to report, I re-downloaded it when I returned. I wasn't as strong as one teenager whose challenges with social media recently went viral. She gave a TED Talk about how to give up on her cell phone. But as John Daly from Colorado Public Radio reports, reality was much more complicated for her. Abby Jones got her first smartphone when she got to middle school. She felt great listening to her favorite tunes, the Beatles, Billy Joel, Elton John. But at other times, social media was making her
really depressed because I was like, oh, I have like two friends and they have like 1,000 followers. Comparing myself to them was definitely a mistake, but I couldn't help it.
Abby, an eighth grader who lives in Denver, found it especially hard dealing with friends.
A while ago, I lost some friends and I was following them on Instagram and I would see them all doing things together. And I would get really sad that I wasn't invited, or we call it FOMO, fear of missing out. And whenever I would lose my phone, I would get a lot of FOMO, and that would also cause a lot of depression and anxiety.
That troubled Abby's mom, Brooke. Abby was using her phone 4 or 5 hours a day, and Brooke found some things on it she didn't like. So she took Abby's phone away.
And that was when she had a meltdown and said, I hate you.
But over time, Abby changed her mind to see her relationship with her phone as an addiction. More than half of teens say they spend too much time on their cell phones, according to a Pew Research Center study.
It's toxic and unhealthy. Like, I'll be just sitting in the lunchroom talking with my friends, and you can see some of the girls sitting next to each other, literally messaging each other on their phones. Very bemused by it. It's very odd.
So Abby decided to tell her tale in a very public way.
I'm 12 years old and currently in 7th grade. I know, you're jealous. Don't be. It's insanely stressful.
Abby told an audience of adults to turn off their phones. Then she educated them on being a teen in today's hyper-connected world, obsessed with chasing social media likes and followers.
Real life disappeared and was replaced by the fake life of Instagram. And then my phone, my everything, was taken away for a whole month.
It was hard at first, but by month's end, without her phone, Abby said she felt liberated.
I no longer had to worry about checking who else had followed me or what new messages I had.
Abby's talk was a hit. When it got posted on YouTube, it was viewed tens of thousands of times. Her principal sent a link to parents at her school. The Today Show invited Abby and Brooke for an interview.
Why was it so important for you to give that speech?
Because of all of the negative mental...
She was the kid who'd figured it all out. The poster child for successfully managing the social media monster. Except, not really.
Like, my mom has a picture of me backstage at my TED Talk, back on Instagram on my phone. So yeah, even after doing my TED Talk, it's still been a struggle.
I spoke to Abby and Brooke at the home they share with their two cats.
Come here. Good boy.
Brooke described Abby's struggle with all the emotions triggered by apps and her phone. She says after the TED Talk, they thought
everything was going to be great because, boy, we've put this message out there and that's it. She solved this problem.
But in reality,
you know, everything just sort of like went downhill from there, which was surprising. Because I wouldn't say that I was super addicted to my phone at that point, but I think it's all tied in.
Abby's parents once again wrestled with how much to allow Abby to be on her phone. Brooke says she struggled with
letting her have it, taking it away, letting her have it back, because for kids now, it's really their lifeline. And so taking that away is, it makes me feel awful. But I also know, I know my kid, and I know that she is struggling when she is on that device.
Things came to a head last summer. On a trip with her grandparents, Abby got free rein over the phone, so she quickly got lost in it again. Brooke got mad and put on strict restrictions, which her daughter still figured out how to get around.
I didn't allow her to have access to the internet or texting.
Abby can't quite give up the phone by herself, even though she can see the upside and describes it as freeing.
But I've definitely come to accept that it's not a big deal if somebody has more followers than you or more likes than you.
Abby has deleted most of her apps, including Instagram. But sometimes she does feel isolated. Recent research shows teens who use social media a lot are more likely to develop mental health problems, like depression and anxiety. Still, Abby says it's not an easy thing to let go.
Honestly, I think the only reason that I'm still not addicted to my phone is because of my parents putting restrictions on it.
Even after all her struggles, Abby sees her relationship with social media as a work in progress. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
Good for Abby.
Yeah.
I think everyone should try that.
It's
teenager
tough.
And otherwise. It is hard, but good for her. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.